I object!
And why is that, Mr. Reed?
Because it's devastating to my case!
I did, you know, the murders, but as you're all so looking forward to this, I thought I'd plead not guilty. Oh.
They say a man who represents himself as a fool for a client. Well, with God as my witness, I am that fool.
Mr. Simpson, this is the most blatant case of fraudulent advertising since my suit against the film The Neverending Story.
Welcome to Opening Arguments, the podcast that pairs an inquisitive interviewer with a real-life lawyer. This podcast is sponsored by the law offices of P. Andrew Torres, LLC, for entertainment purposes, is not intended as legal advice, and does not form an attorney-client relationship. Don't take legal advice from a podcast.
Hello and welcome to Opening Arguments. This is episode 153. I'm your host, Thomas Smith. That over there is Andrew Torres. How are you doing, Andrew?
I'm great, Thomas. How are you?
I'm good. I've got both my basketball sports gear ready and my Yodel Mountain Brew. I guess we'll add in to tie all the segments together. I've also got my John Oliver mug or something like that. So that's what we're going to talk about today. We've got...
Nobody themes a show like Thomas, ladies and gentlemen.
Yeah, it seems like kind of a waste because I don't show anybody. But yeah, I get in full gear, just for every segment. I've got, little flags and cups and all that stuff. But you can't see
it. He was actually wearing the raccoon outfit last episode.
I mean, that's true, but that's also just a normal everyday thing. So
I will never terminate our relationship on the basis of your weekend activities. I promise.
Well, now that I've learned, I can't sue. I hope not. So hopefully you've got your Yodel Mountain Ale because we're gonna be a yodeling a little bit, talking about Hicks, Gates, Manafort, Kushner, all that good stuff. And then we're going to talk about college basketball, a little bit of scandal erupting there, indictments and such, paying off kids. That's going to be a really interesting one. And then finally, the Murray Energy lawsuit, the John Oliver case where he tried to sue him for calling him names and stuff like that. That was dismissed. Andrew's going to talk to us about that. But in the meantime, you've got a little announcement for next week.
Yeah, I am really, really excited about this. Friend of the show, he's never been on, but David Michael from the My Book of Mormon podcast, and truly, I think, one of the sexiest voices in podcasting, right? Like David Michael, Seth Andrews, like those two are right up there. He is going to take up the mantle of defending originalism. So we're going to do a deep dive into originalism as a judicial philosophy. I stand by my assessment that originalism is disqualifying to serve on the Supreme Court. It is a fringe political ideology that has no basis in the law. But maybe David will change my mind on that.
It is disqualifying, and therefore we have like four justices that are currently sitting there close to originalists. Yeah. But it should be disqualifying. If there were any justice in the world. But all right, well, that's going to be exciting. And then, little mini Andrew was wrong segment, huh?
Yeah, I got a couple of folks wrote to me. My dog lover cred is on the line. In TTTB 64, that was dog law, I mispronounced the name of the breed, which is apparently pronounced Basenji. I think I called it Basenji. I'm channeling. There's a super trend. Anyway.
I would have known or cared because I'm a cat person.
right. And so, I got to tell you, like, to team dog, like, if you don't want to lose me over to team cat, maybe ixnay on the correcting my pronunciation. Mini Andrew was wrong. It's Basenji, and I will carry that knowledge going forward.
Awesome. Well, Andrew was wrong, everyone. All right, now let's get to Yodel Mountain.
Because people have got to know whether or not their president is a crook. Nobody so you're not aware of any context during the course of the election?
How many times do I have to answer this question?
Can you just say
Russia
yes or no
is
on
a
it?
Ruse. Yeah, I know you have to get up and ask a question so important. Russia is a ruse.
Well, I'm not a crook.
So Hope Hicks, I think she lasted, what was the figure? 18 Scaramucci's? They're measuring things in terms of Scaramucci now.
Increments of the mooch now?
Yeah, because clearly his tenure was one Scaramucci, you know, which is 10 days or something.
It's like the astronomical unit. I just want to point out, I have a prop here that's going to go to good use. This is my can of Yodel Mountain Ale.
Whoa, what a sound. The listeners, that was such a good sound effect that the listeners might think Brian just put it in post. It was like you had a Foley man there. That was incredible. What a nice pop on that can.
Yeah, we have a lot of yodeling to do.
All right.
And you know that probably this is obsolete by the time this airs, because as we know, Mueller likes to drop news on Friday evening, knowing that we record on Thursday. I think it is also worth it. I've gotten a couple of emails and posts and the like in continuing to drive home the message. I think this is critical for Democrats to do this in the 2018 midterm elections. Where we are on Yodel Mountain is we now have indictments that have been handed down against former KGB agents, against Russian employees of a troll farm based in St. Petersburg that if the allegation is to be believed, and they are sufficient to have secured indictments from the grand jury, that there was active intervention by a hostile foreign power in our elections. And our president does not seem to care. Yeah. And that's kind of a problem. And so I sort of wanted to lead off with...
You would think it would be a problem, wouldn't you? The same guy who thinks originalism disqualifies you from being a justice thinks it's a problem if your president just decides he doesn't care that we were attacked.
Yeah.
What an idealist you are. Poor naive Andrew.
I want to drill down on exactly what that means. Admiral Michael S. Rogers, he is the outgoing head of the National Security Agency. He is the individual who was in charge of the military's cyber command, and he testified before the U.S. Senate on his way out. And his testimony is that the White House has not ordered the National Security Agency to take any affirmative steps to counter Moscow's efforts to meddle in U.S. elections, right? Not since Trump has taken office, despite the evidence, despite the fact that they have declared that they intend to meddle in our elections, despite the fact that we are gearing up for the 2018 midterm elections right now. And
since Trump. But yeah.
Yes. But all of those efforts are coordinated through the military cyber command. And his testimony was that the White House has not asked his agencies to find ways to counter Moscow and then certainly because they haven't asked, they have not granted additional funding for our government to combat cyber attacks and cyber terrorism and interference in our elections. I would find that troubling regardless of the political party that is in office. I think at the moment, I know we don't have a lot of Trump supporters among our listeners, but to me, if you do, if you got an Uncle Frank who's pro-Trump, and right, supposedly pro-military, right? You might want to ask why aren't we spending money on cybersecurity? Why are we not funding and authorizing career military professionals? Right, Rogers is not a Democrat.
Yeah,
and he warned in 2017 that Russia was using cyber attacks, digital security to exacerbate political and social divisions in the United States, and everybody who has testified has said the White House's response is nothing. So, all right. So there's Rogers.
Him. Okay, game over. He's not president anymore, right?
Hope Hicks is resigning as White House communications director after her testimony before the Senate Intelligence Committee that, from time to time she lies on behalf of Donald Trump. But she's totally not lying now when she says that she's never lied about Trump's connections to Russia.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. And I am not a huge Erin Burnett fan, but Erin Burnett wrote an article for CNN in which she reported one of her sources, one of Trump's close allies, told her that Trump asked Hicks after her testimony, quote, "How could you be so stupid?" End quote. Wow. There's not a lot that I agree with Donald Trump on if these reports are accurate, but maybe don't send your communications director out to the Senate Intelligence Committee to concede that she often lies on your behalf. OPEX, you will recall, was actively involved in, some say she was the one who drafted the White House statement that was issued in July of 2017 regarding the Trump Tower meeting.
Yeah.
She was interviewed by Mueller back in December and spent 2 days testifying to the Senate Intelligence Committee. And here's what I think the significance of Hicks leaving is. She has been a Trump loyalist, obviously, but once you are out of the White House, look, we know, right? We know from Stormy Daniels what the president uses to try and compel silence when you've left. And that is, I am certain that she has signed a non-disclosure agreement. But as we have discussed on the show, that NDA is not going to be enforceable. And if she realizes that the NDA is not enforceable, if she's not around people all the time who are sort of leaning on her not to, spill the beans, I think that there is some potential pressure that could be brought to bear there. And we're going to have to find out. This is the sort of the Jenga game right now is that, Donald Trump has so far managed to maintain the loyalty of his closest cronies, but those are starting, right? Like there are,
he's running out of metaphors. Cronies. They've all left. Right. There's nobody.
Yeah. And he has not really stuck by them on their way out. Right. Ultimately, at the end of the day, and this is going to be relevant as we talk about Manafort, you're going to have to ask yourself, if you're a Hope Hicks, if you're a Paul Manafort, at the end of the day, if Donald Trump has to choose between himself and you, what side of the ledger do you think he's going to come down on? And, I know where I would place my bets on that. So, so let's talk about Manafort now, right? It's crowded up here on Yodel Mountain. A little over a week ago on Thursday, February 22nd, at night after we recorded that day, of course, Mueller introduced what's called a superseding indictment. And a superseding indictment is exactly what it sounds like. It is, there are already charges pending against people, and we want to file all kinds of new charges against them.
But if it's superseding, does it undo other charges?
Nope. Okay. They just sit on top of. So. Okay. So the superseding indictment charges Manafort and Richard Gates with collectively 32 new counts. These are all related to the tax evasion, bank fraud, overseas secret payments from Ukraine to Manafort and Gates and their efforts to evade U.S. taxes. You put them all together and now all of a sudden Manafort and Gates are looking collectively at enough, at hundreds of years of prison time. And these indictments are exceedingly thorough. They name specific bank accounts. They name specific dates, times, entities, location. I'm going to link the indictment in the show notes. It is, right, we have due process, you're innocent until proven guilty, all that. It is a damning indictment. And it should not be surprising, although it came as a great surprise to Paul Manafort, that these indictments came down Thursday night. And by Monday morning, Mueller had announced that Richard Gates was now pleading guilty, that the most recent 22 counts that were filed against him in the Eastern District of Virginia were going to be withdrawn, and that Manafort was going to plead guilty, and the sentencing guidelines for the offenses to which he has pled guilty will result in him serving 6 years in prison. That can be subject to a motion for a downward departure that could be made by Mueller in the case. Mm. And one of the ways in which you might get that is by demonstrating cooperation and active and enthusiastic and vigorous cooperation, because Gates's plea deal, right, like the Papadopoulos plea deal that we discussed way back at the beginning of the indictment phase of Yodel Mountain, I should say, about halfway up, I don't know, is contingent upon his full and complete and 100% truthful cooperation with Mueller's investigation.
Interesting. Now, I've seen some people, though, say that it's still possible that this is just what they could get them on. Like, is it, what do you put the odds on that it's, oh, there's some bigger target, or it's Trump, or it's whatever, versus, eh, this is just kind of what they could get them on, and they're taking a plea deal to just make sure they get something? What are the odds of that?
So let me break that down into a couple constituent questions. Richard Gates was Manafort's right-hand man. His fingerprints are all over the illegal wire fraud and illegal offshore accounts and tax evasion. He's a bad guy. Mm. So I want to be clear on this. It is entirely possible. There is nothing in the latest indictments to indicate a connection yet to Donald Trump. Okay.
Right.
So it is, we mentioned this. I always want us to be clear on this. We mentioned this in our first discussion of Manafort's indictment when we had Professor Randall Eliason on the show, that it's entirely possible that that's where it ends, right? That it goes no higher than Manafort. And if that's all that it goes, then obviously that would be, I think, disappointing for those of us who are, you know, watching Rome burning around us. But nevertheless, that would be a plausible use of prosecutorial powers, right? Like, Manafort has defrauded the U.S. government out of tens of millions of dollars, according to the indictment, right? So you would want to bring that person in, recoup that money, and put that person behind bars. So yes, it is possible that the cooperation is just with Gates to flip on Manafort because Manafort is a bad guy. I have to say, and again, civil lawyer, not a criminal lawyer, but the folks that I've talked to, it does not seem likely to me that you would flip somebody who is 70% of a bad guy just to get Manafort, right? The case against Manafort is going exceedingly well by all accounts. We've talked about how Manafort's bail application resulted in him submitting fraudulent reports to the Eastern District of Virginia in connection with his pending cases, right? So he was claiming that there were properties that he could use to help finance his bail that were not a part of the indictment. And turns out that they were, right? So, the case against Manafort does not, in my view, seem to require as much help that you would want to let Gates skate by on 6 years or less. And Gates has done some truly awful stuff. So I want to give that full lead out, right? This does not, there's nothing in the document that connects this to Donald Trump, but we are, if you're trying to surmise, it strikes me as unlikely that Mueller, who has been very judicious with the individuals with whom he's cut deals, that he would cut a deal with a fish as big as Gates. And again, I want to let me be clear, a fish as big as Gates in the context of the Manafort indictment, right? Mm-hmm. Like, it's not that Gates has a particularly huge role. He was a deputy campaign director, but I don't know the relationship between Gates and Trump. But if all you had was Manafort, I don't think you would cut the deal with Gates. That's right. My take.
Okay.
There's a second thing too, which is I have to believe that at some point, I think it is very clear Manafort has not turned on Trump at the moment.
Really?
I have to think at some point, the guy who is used to negotiating with strongmen is going to volunteer to turn on Trump. Right now, it may never happen, right? He may say, okay, I'm going to fight this all the way. I'm going to go to prison. It, you know what? He might do a Chuck Colson and find Jesus and come out. And, you know, all of that is possible.
Well, or rely on a pardon, right?
Yeah, well, but a pardon will pardon him for these activities, but will not pardon him for activities that can be brought by the New York State Attorney General, okay. Eric Schneiderman, that Eric Schneiderman has already said if the Manafort case is dismissed that they will bring those charges.
Okay, awesome.
And let's also be clear. Because I'm glad you brought that up, because I want to drill it, because you see that all the time, right? Manafort is just sitting there thinking Donald Trump's going to pardon him. Donald Trump's going to pardon him. There are two things that I would sort of urge as caution with respect to that. Number one is even Donald Trump right now is not coordinating with Paul Manafort, right? Mm. Like Donald Trump is not talking to Manafort at the moment. And Donald Trump, unless he is even stupider than anyone has suggested to date, is not sending back channel messages to Paul Manafort right now. Like any communication between Trump and Manafort right now would be disastrous for both of them. Right? Huh. So the pardon is something that has to go on entirely within Paul Manafort's head. And if you're Paul Manafort, right, I'm sure Trump has said, oh yeah, don't worry. I'll pardon you. But if you're looking at it, you'd have to ask yourself number one, I might still be on the hook for state charges. Number two, is Trump willing to risk the political capital of pardoning me? And I get that, you know, we've been living in an age in which there are very few consequences. I have to think pardoning Manafort would shake loose some Republicans. Maybe it doesn't, right? Maybe we are at the point where there
Republicans in office or Republican
voters? I mean
voters?
Republicans in office, okay. To condemn that. Because Manafort's crime, because think about the position, and this is, I think, part of the brilliance of Mueller, right? The position the White House has taken is, oh yeah, all that stuff on Manafort is stuff before the campaign,
right.
And doesn't have anything to do with me. It's all real estate from 2014. So fake news.
Yeah. Trump just hires the best people is all.
Right. So think about that. If that's your line, how do you go out and pardon Manafort?
Yeah.
You can't say this is a political witch hunt, because even, you know, Susan Collins is going to say this. You've said over and over again, and the charges have nothing to do with you and with the Russia investigation. This is about the United States recouping tens of millions of dollars of unpaid taxes on money that was laundered from hostile foreign governments. Are you really pardoning this guy? And I'm a notorious optimist, so maybe we are at the point where there is no one left to, you know, cry out the, you know, at long last, have you no sense of decency, sir? But
yeah.
I think that's I would put that as kind of a number two. And then the number three is, even if you don't think that there's going to be a political backlash, I don't know how much I would count on Donald Trump's loyalty if my surname was not Trump or Kushner. Right. So, you know, so when you're sitting there, eventually, I think the way in which I'll say it this way, if I were a prosecutor and I believe that Paul Manafort had incredibly damning information on the president, this is how I would go about getting Paul Manafort to flip. Not saying that I do or I don't, right? But this is what I would do.
Makes sense.
Last.
I hope you're right. I hope we're not going to be doing the ultimate Andrew was wrong at the end of all this yodeling. We'll see.
Yeah, me too. Last person up here on this very crowded base camp on Yodel Mountain is our buddy Jared Kushner.
You mean in addition
Kushner.
To all the just hammered listeners just kind of moseying.
Right. Oh yeah, time for a nice cool refreshing sip here. I've been going for a
while. In the spectator area, they're just kind of cans strewn about, they're just passed out.
I like to think of Yodel Mountain, a base camp on Yodel Mountain as kind of being the opening arguments equivalent of Burning Man, right? Like everyone gets
exactly.
around, a huge party, we're all drinking our beer. So, Jared Kushner, news has come out that White House
He lost his clearance, right? He's down.
Yeah, White House Chief of Staff John Kelly downgraded his clearance, his interim clearance. He still has no actual clearance, which, yeah, has downgraded him from top secret to secret. And here's why this is important. Jared Kushner is one of the few people left in the White House whom Donald Trump trusts. And at this point, by having a secret clearance and not a top secret clearance, it means that Jared Kushner cannot be handed the presidential daily briefing, which we know he has received to date.
I saw that like millions of people have secret clearance. Like it's a level that is a lot of government employees have.
Yeah. No, I believe that my wife has had a secret clearance before. She's done some IT work for governmental agencies. That to be denied a secret clearance is, you know, requires there to be, you know, massive problems. Secret clearance is not hard to get. It's time consuming, but it would be surprising for an ordinary person with an ordinary background to be denied secret clearance. So what do I mean by ordinary person with an ordinary background? I mean, you could disclose, you know, prior drug use, prior misdemeanor convictions.
Because, that, you know, because, and I've heard a lot of podcasts talk about this. It's not based on like, have you never done anything wrong? It's based on, could you be subject to blackmail? That's what most of the questions are around. Are you a risk that someone knows something about you and is going to, therefore, you would be a like, you could be a potential leak. You could be a, you know, that kind of thing. It's not, oh, have you never gotten a parking ticket or something like that?
Yeah, that's exactly right. And so the question is, what has Jared Kushner done that renders him blackmailable? Why are we a year into the administration and his application is not being processed? And the answer is, in 2007, Jared Kushner and his family bought a property in New York, 666 Fifth Avenue, like the address. They bought the building for $1.8 billion in 2007. And now, as we have talked about, again, we have no evidence that this was anything other than a straightforward sale. But as the Manafort indictment shows, this is often how people launder money from overseas. Again, there's no evidence of that in the case of Kushner. What there is evidence is that Kushner companies bought the property for $1.8 billion in 2007. In 2008, the high-end real estate market took a rather large hit. The property was refinanced because Kushner could not meet the payments. And that is a balloon payment that is now coming due in January of 2019 of $1.2 billion. And we know, there's been excellent reporting by the Washington Post on this, that Kushner has been actively seeking investors to try and, foreign investors, other nations, to come in to try and raise money, because otherwise he's not going to be able to pay the $1.2 billion. The most recent report from the Washington Post, I'll link it in the show notes, is that the United Arab Emirates, China, Israel, and Mexico had all engaged in private discussions about Jared Kushner as a potential target for manipulation due to his financial ineptitude and due to his, what the word that the article uses is naivete. So as someone to be, look, we have affirmative evidence that foreign powers are trying to pick off weak and exposed individuals in the government. And Jared Kushner is among the weakest and most exposed. And so that's where we are with Kushner. He's now in this sort of catch-22 situation that either Donald Trump can freeze him out, at which point...
Yeah, but then if he's not able to get these briefings, how's he going to solve Middle East peace and solve the opioid epidemic and solve the and solve poverty and solve all the... Just basically all the jobs that he has.
Yeah. And he had all the, I mean, like, you're cracking the joke, but like, he had all of those jobs within the administration. So either Trump can hang him out to dry, or Trump can get him information and be violating the law. So it's the significance here of the downgrade. I think it was done because Kelly thinks that Trump will not violate the law in order to do that. And I think that was the only way that he could isolate Kushner and his massive outsized influence in the White House. But I think Kelly may have misunderestimated Donald Trump. So we'll find out.
We'll see. So, yeah, I don't know.
So busy Yodel Mountain style party here at base camp, but there we go. That's
everyone's gonna be that's so the news. Hammered by the end of this Yodel Mountain journey. All right, well, it's always fun to hear a little yodeling, so thanks for the breakdown. All right, Andrew, what's going on in college basketball?
Yeah, Thomas, just a couple of days ago, Yahoo Sports broke a story about the FBI's investigation into corruption in college basketball. And I think there are a bunch of really interesting issues here, especially because we are headed into March Madness season. And the NCAA, the governing body that oversees college basketball, earns $900 million per year. And of that $900 million, almost 90% of it, about $800 million, is earned during the NCAA National Tournament, March Madness. This is not overly surprising. Almost all of that is TV revenue. Big bucks. Obviously, March Madness itself is even bigger bucks. I did a little bit of research. The American Gaming Association estimates that 100 million people fill in the United States. That's a third of the population. Fill out March Madness brackets. I know I do. I don't know if you do. In fact, we could have an opening arguments bracket challenge.
Let's do it. Opening arguments in the group. It's the best part of the year where everybody who does not follow it all year has no idea what they're doing. All of a sudden, becomes an expert and says, "Oh, I can't believe my six pick didn't beat the whatever seed," and we all, but it's fun. I don't blame anybody because it is really fun, but yeah. It's funny how we all get, what an upset that I didn't know anything about 5 minutes ago. we'll do it for OA. It'll be fun.
An estimated $9.2 billion will be gambled on the tournament. 81.5 million employees are expected to spend at least an hour of company time filling out a bracket, costing their employers $2.1 billion, according to calculations by Challenger, Gray, and Christmas, an accounting firm.
Companies need to start incorporating it somehow into what their work is, because that's a lot of lost time.
Yeah,
they got to find a way to repurpose it or something, so it's also productive time.
Yeah, I'm sure we could come up with some kind of. Corporate trust
building. Well, that just goes to tell you, it might actually is, I know this is a sidebar, but maybe it's a smart thing to just as an office be like, all right, everybody, this is a work gathering. You've got a half hour to do all your, a designated half hour to do all your bracket filling and then minimize that loss. Cause that's a staggering number you just read.
Yeah. Yeah. And now with all this money, with all this money flowing back to schools, you want to take a guess as to what percentage of schools broke even or made money off of their college basketball program?
What percent? And is this just Division I?
Division I schools, right.
Division I schools. Yes. Oh, okay. Division I schools. So there's, I feel like there's not that many. Man, I would imagine, they're always building crap and paying coaches a lot and all that. But on the other hand, they don't have to pay the athletes. That's the thing.
Mm-hmm.
Well, allegedly, they shouldn't be paying.
I love how you've seen my clumsy attempts at foreshadowing here.
yeah. I would, the way you asked it was going to sound like none of them, but at the same time, they don't have to pay for this labor. I mean, they pay coaching staff and all that, but it seems like such a good business for them. I'll go with 80%.
Yeah, it is one third of the schools. Or made a profit. And you're exactly right on that tension, right? They're getting the labor for free. And we know the fair market value of the labor because current NCAA rules require basketball players to spend 1 year in college. The University of Kentucky has rotated kids through, that they typically lose their entire starting lineup every year and have a new crop of kids that come in. and they then go into the NBA and make tens of millions of dollars. So we know what the market value of the labor that is being provided is. It's a lot, but yeah, only the big schools are really making money off of it. And look, there are about 200 Division I NCAA programs. So when you think that the tournament has 68 entries, right, that's about the number. in terms of that breakthrough.
Is that 68? How are we getting 68? Are there some playing
games?
Yeah,
there are four play-in games that get to 68.
Okay. Yeah. Oh, yeah, that's right. They did start doing that with like the last seeds.
Yeah.
Huh?
And so the top as of 2014, the most profitable schools from publicly available data were Louisville, which brought in $24.2 million in 2014, and the University of Arizona, which both of these will feature in our story, which was second at $17.7 million. So that's the background. You have this unbelievably lucrative tournament that is an event that a third of the country loves, that is producing billions of dollars in revenue. And the people who are generating that cannot be paid. In fact, these are the NCAA bylaws. 16.01.1 says a student athlete shall not receive any extra benefit, period. Receipt by a student athlete of an award, benefit, or expense allowance not authorized by NCAA legislation renders the student athlete ineligible for athletics competition in the sport for which the improper award, benefit, or expense was received. If the student athlete receives an extra benefit not authorized by NCAA legislation, the individual is ineligible in all sports. Okay? So pretty draconian, pretty harsh. It says you may not be paid. You may not receive any benefit of any kind. And I will tell you, for outside of the realm of college basketball, when you're talking about, say, Division III college baseball, when you were talking about sports for which there is not billions of dollars in revenue kicking around, coaches and students take that very, very seriously. And it has come to include things like coaches being afraid to give kids rides home from practice, right? Mm. If I give you a ride home in my car, is that a benefit? Well, you didn't have to take an $11 cab home, right? And kids and coaches agonize over that. And I want you to keep that in mind. Now, I should add, yeah, there's a sub clause under it that says for violations of that previous bylaw, which the value of the benefit is $100 or less, the eligibility of the student athlete shall not be affected, conditioned upon the student athlete repaying the value of the benefit to a charity of his or her choice.
Interesting.
The student shall, however, shall remain ineligible from the time the institution has knowledge of the receipt of the impermissible benefit until the time that the student athlete repays the benefit. For violations in which there is no monetary value, violations shall be considered institutional violations, but shall not affect the student athlete's eligibility. So, you know, there's a $100 exception in terms of eligibility, but notice that that is conditioned upon paying it back, and you're ineligible from the time of discovery until the time that you pay it back. So, you know, there's kind of a chilling effect outside of this area that we're about to discuss that says, no, yeah, like you can't take anything.
Yeah.
So.
And I know nobody asked my opinion, but these people really should just be professional athletes and they should be separate from schools. But anyway, go on.
I agree with that 100%. There was it's not college basketball, but when Johnny Manziel left Texas A&M, he was the quarterback at Texas A&M. I believe it was Forbes, did a report on the Texas A&M school endowment, which had previously fluctuated between $200 and $400 million, and it was in the 200s before Johnny Manziel played at Texas A&M, and then went to $700 million while he was there.
Jeez.
So, you know, yeah, like you look at it and say, it's not hard to figure out what Johnny Manziel's value to Texas A&M was. And the fact that we have created the system where
they don't get any of that. Yeah. And then if they are a bust in the NFL, it's just their.
Yeah, NFL. Which he is. Right. So there you go. Right. Yeah. It's he created arguably, but I think you have a very good argument that he created nine figures of revenue for Texas A&M. And what he is left with is a degree as an Aggie and a failed career as a Cleveland Brown. So that's not.
Yeah, that's its other corollary is the Cleveland Browns shouldn't be professional athletes. They should be they should be the equivalent. They shouldn't be paid.
I agree with that. Like, I think Ohio State could probably beat the Cleveland Browns.
Yeah, just absorb them, some school or something.
All right. So what's the news? The news is that the FBI has leaked documents and bank records that were obtained discovery in an investigation into college basketball. That investigation focuses on former NBA agent Andy Miller and his associate, 25-year-old named Christian Dawkins, and their agency, ASM Sports. I have seen this. It is pages of pages of Excel spreadsheets that list individual players and then the benefit convert onto them, which is described as loans to players and then the dollar value amount. And they are described as loans because, you know, you want to maintain the pretense that these are not outright gifts. They are, obviously, outright gifts. And the FBI has handed down four indictments against coaches. All four of these coaches have been fired. They are Emmanuel Book Richardson, who's the assistant coach at Arizona, Lamont Evans from Oklahoma State, Tony Bland from USC, and Chuck Person from Auburn. How does the FBI have jurisdiction here? They do because the Division I schools are agents of federally funded organizations because they do more than $10,000 a year in business with the federal government, whether through grants, contracts, loans, other collaborations, right? So all of these schools receive money in interstate commerce with the federal government. So therefore, the FBI can investigate into the world of college basketball. And the real news that came out was a story from ESPN that says that the FBI has a wiretapped conversation between the aforementioned Christian Dawkins, the 25-year-old agent, and the head coach at Arizona, whose name is Sean Miller. And that story says that there is a wiretap in which Miller agrees to pay $100,000 for what was then one of the top recruits in college basketball, DeAndre Ayton, who did in fact go to Arizona. And that I should add, DeAndre Ayton is one of the best college basketball players in the country, right? He is a guaranteed, you know.
I don't follow and I don't know who that is, but in a few weeks when I fill out my bracket, I will feel like I'm an expert.
Yeah. he's averaging 19.6 points per game. That's a lot. 10.9 rebounds per game. That's huge. I think he leads all of Division I in rebounds per game.
So he's averaging a double-double. Not bad.
And so he is on the short list for National Player of the Year. I would add, I told you that Arizona fired Book Richardson. They have not so much as placed Sean Miller or DeAndre Ayton on leave or asked him to stop playing or anything in associated with that. And I should add, I went to look to find the other side of this, right? Because, you know, all of a sudden you've got reports saying you paid $100,000 for a player. What's the other side? What's the defense as to why this school hasn't done anything? And there is a piece in Sports Illustrated, I'm going to link it in the show notes, that encourages some skepticism about the ESPN piece claiming to have the wiretap. And here are the points they make, and I want to kind of comment on this. So they say, number one, the story provides zero direct quotes from the wiretap. Right. And then they add the gloss of suggesting that the reporter hasn't listened to the recording or even seen a transcript of the call. I don't know that I would draw that conclusion. It certainly could be the case that you have a confidential source that required you not to quote directly from the wiretap. But okay, whatever. There has been some confusion about when the wiretap took place. The initial story said that it took place in the spring of 2017, but that would have been after Ayton already signed to play with Arizona. And now the ESPN story says that the call took place in 2016. You know, so take that for whatever that's worth. And then it goes on to say that it includes the passage. Sources say that the U.S. Attorney's Office received multiple parties who had conversations with Dawkins that their phone calls had been recorded specifically during the dates of June 19th, 2017 and September 25th, 2017. So in other words, the argument is no, 2017 seems to be the time in which the FBI had wiretapped, but that would not be sufficient time to prove a conversation for bringing Ayton in because he'd already signed his LOI by then. And then the additional points are some recruiter, and I have no way to pass any judgment on this, but some people who follow college recruiting seem to think that Ayton didn't really have much of a relationship with ASM Sports. And I should add parenthetically, amateurs are not allowed to sign with the sports agency, but the way in which you get around that is you have a person as your quote advisor. And then they are effectively acting as your agent, but you just don't pay them until you go pro. So yeah, it baseball is the most ridiculous because you know, college kids and high school kids are not allowed to retain an agent and still maintain their eligibility to play, you know, to play amateur ball. And so these kids who think about going out for the draft are like, well, I have, you know, developed a sudden fondness and friendship with Scott Boras. And it's ridiculous. But anyway, so these guys seem to think that ASM Sports didn't have a good relationship with Ayton and so wouldn't have been in a position to sell him to Arizona in the first place. I am going to include, I believe I have mentioned this before. It is one of my favorite things. It is the original scouting report on Bo Jackson that was filed by the Kansas City Royals when Bo Jackson was in high school. And the same scout continued to follow Bo Jackson throughout college. His college report is the more famous one in which it's all sevens and eights. And I should add, like, baseball scouting is on a 20 to 80 scale and so or 2 to 8 scale. And eight means Hall of Famer or at the top 1 to 2 at your position in the major leagues, right? So, you know, to use the Dodgers, for example, right? Like Clayton Kershaw is not all eights on his scouting report, right? Like it is, yeah, really?
Wow.
He's really, good. Really good. Yeah. Aaron Judge is an eight in power. Okay. So, that's the level of hyperbole when you get to that. And the scout in the 85 report calls Bo Jackson the best athlete in America right now, which, probably true. The 82 report from high school says it's much less glowing, right? It says, you know, this is a future major leaguer, right? It's got good numbers. And then when it comes to the question of should we draft him, it says we should not draft him because he's signed to play football at Auburn, which is, you know, he did. And there's no way we can pay as much as Auburn is paying him. I love that because it's common knowledge that, you know, it was common knowledge in 1982 that your top players were going to get paid by the school. There's a little bit of the, I'm shocked to find that there's gambling going on in this establishment going on.
Right.
So there we go. That's the college basketball story. We're going to keep our eyes on it. I agree with you that in my mind, all of this is kind of a smokescreen that is created by the fact that you have a multi-billion-dollar enterprise in which the creative genius, in which the talent that has given rise to the value, are playing for zero. And I don't see, I don't think there's any realistic chance. Like you have to, and I love college basketball, right? Like I really do. I grew up with it.
Yeah. It's really exciting. I think the tournament, I mean, even though I don't pretend like I know about it, but the tournament is always great. It's every game seemingly comes down to the last minute. Oftentimes it's just,
it's awesome. And I love that, but if you are laboring under the impression that, you know, well, everyone is fine, but, you know, but my school and your school is a perennial participant in the NCAA tournament. My school is clean. Like, your school is not clean. It and I think, you know, we can appreciate what's going on the court and still want the people who are creating that to get a cut of their work product. I don't think it would diminish the tournament at all if colleges paid their athletes. I don't think it would diminish college football. I don't think it would diminish college basketball. I'd like to see those guys get a cut of the money they're generating. So there we go.
Yeah, no kidding. They really should. Yeah. All right. Well, thanks for that deep dive, and on to the next segment here.
Hey there, Mr. Nutter Butter. I understand that you have a message for Bob Murray.
I do.
Okay.
Hey, Bob. Just wanted to say, if you're planning on suing, I do not have $1 billion. But I do have a check for 3 acorns and 18 cents.
Oh, that's very nice of you, Mr. Nutter Butter.
It is.
Yeah.
It's made out to eat shit, Bob. Memorize, kiss my ass.
Andrew, let's talk about this very fun, very exciting, very hilarious lawsuit filed against John Oliver for his mockery of this odious Murray guy. What's going on here?
Yeah, Bob Murray, CEO of Murray Energy. We covered this on episode 84. And then...
Wow, I can't believe it's been that long. Jeez.
Yeah, it's been a while. And then we had to revisit again in episode 93 when friend of the show, Jamie Lynn Crofts, who is the ACLU director of West Virginia, filed what we called the best legal brief ever written, the amicus brief in support of John Oliver, in which the headlines were, it's perfectly okay for John Oliver to say, eat shit, Bob. And here's the lawsuit, right? So on Last Week Tonight, which shamelessly steals from the show, we have proven that time and time again, John Oliver said—
Yeah, our lawsuit's still pending, by the way. We haven't quite, that hasn't been resolved yet.
Yeah. Well, all the good lawyers have signed up to represent John Oliver, so it's been a challenge for us to find good quality legal representation. So Oliver was about to run another segment on Murray Energy, and then he took to the podium and said, "So I have to proceed with caution here because they've gotten a cease and desist letter. I'm not going to say, for instance, that Bob Murray looks like a geriatric Dr. Evil, even though he clearly does." And then put up, you know, side by side images of Murray and Dr. Evil, which he totally does look like a geriatric Dr. Evil. Oliver then went on to explain that Murray had a history of lawsuits against the media, and that one such lawsuit against a newspaper, Murray's general counsel, quote, told reporters that his paper had inflicted a potential economic loss of, and I'm not making this up, $1 billion. And then Oliver said, obviously, that's exactly what you'd expect from a geriatric Dr. Evil. Then Oliver went on to describe a program, a bonus program at the mine that gave miners bonuses based on the amount of coal that they extracted in any one given year, and then did a split screen with the NLRB decision that gave miners the right to vote out of, to opt out of the program. And then Oliver explained that when the program was voted down by miners over the safety concerns, Murray Energy imposed it anyway, saying that miners could void their bonus checks if they did not want to participate. And so then they proceeded to show all of these canceled checks that miners wrote, now, you know, refusing to take the bonuses. And so one miner wrote, "Eat shit, Bob," on his voided check. Another wrote, "Kiss my ass, Bob." And they put them up on the screen. And so it became known as the Eat Shit Bob lawsuit. As we pointed out, the CEO of Murray Energy, when speaking on issues of coal mining in West Virginia, is a public figure. And Bob Murray is somebody who has sought the spotlight. He's very clearly a public figure. New York Times v. Sullivan Standard, Bat Boy, no chance that this lawsuit was going anywhere.
Each shit is clearly within the Bat Boy standard.
Yeah.
Well within it.
Exactly right.
You can probably tell him to eat all kinds of things.
And
this is a clean show. We won't say what, but
yeah. And so after what the judge describes as thorough and careful consideration of the defendant's motion for dismissal, the plaintiff's response and the defendant's reply to the same, as well as all arguments in support and in opposition to the motion to dismiss, I, the judge, find the arguments set forth in the defendant's motion to dismiss for failure to state a claim and reply well-founded, appropriate in this matter, and will grant the same. And then says the court adopts, with little exception, defendant's arguments in support of their motion regarding all issues addressed. The remaining motion to dismiss for lack of personal jurisdiction is therefore moot. And then counsel for defendants are directed to prepare an order, including finding of facts and conclusions of law supporting the court's ruling and to send it to the court. This prompted a reply from Murray Energy, which says they intend to appeal this decision to the West Virginia Supreme Court. So we're not done. Hopefully our friend Jamie will file yet another brief. We're looking forward to that. Maybe she'll come on the show after filing that. She said it's just a matter of scheduling. She wants to come on the show. Her writing is brilliant. The Murray Energy says this decision contains absolutely no legal reasoning whatsoever. It instead blindly adopts the defendant's deeply flawed arguments.
This
is a flagrant disregard of the law, the facts, and the substantial damages intentionally inflicted by defendants. Clearly, this decision is detrimental to our employees who rely on Mr. Murray and Murray Energy for their continued livelihoods and to our lenders, customers, and suppliers who depend upon our integrity and performance. I quote the statement, A, because it's funny, and B, because you see this happen from time to time when people lose in court is they will often make an insinuation that there's something inappropriate about a court adopting one party's language from their brief in the opinions. The last time I saw that was in the Kitzmiller versus Dover case, and the Discovery Institute said, look, the judge didn't, you know, even though that was like 192 pages and, you know, tons of it were original. Like there was a section in which the judge quoted pretty much verbatim from the.
So they try to cry foul like, oh, he's in the pocket of that guy because he quoted their brief or something.
Right. And this is, again, as somebody who litigates, who wins, I think I win more than I lose, but you know, I win sometimes, who loses sometimes. It is totally normal in civil litigation for a judge to adopt the reasoning of the opposing side, right? Of one of the parties. It is totally normal for a judge to quote from your brief in an opinion. In fact, I mean, it's kind of one of the, you know, like points of bragging in the office when, you know, I would talk to my other partners and go, oh, hey, look, you know, I got, you know, Judge so-and-so to adopt exactly my language here. I mean, particularly when I was able to work a good turn of phrase and then the judge proceeded to use that in her opinion. I would brag about that. It's a totally normal thing. There is absolutely nothing nefarious about it. And I suspect that, we may see that, you know, when Trump starts losing in court. So I want to flag that right now. There's nothing inappropriate about a judge adopting the other side's brief and quoting from it at length in opinions. So,
right. It's not as though it goes the other way around. It's not the judge likes that side. So therefore he or she adopts the language. It's, oh, that is the better argument. So that's the language, you know, right? I mean, it's not like the favoritism.
Correctly.
Yeah. Okay. Well, that's hilarious. Is there anything else with that? Or were we,
nope. No, we're done.
Okay. Well, that's hilarious. I'm glad that John Oliver can go back to just stealing from us regularly in his regularly scheduled program. So we'll see what he's covering this week. Thanks for that breakdown, as always. And now it is time to thank our new patrons.
Oh, I love New Patron Tuesday.
Absolutely, at patreon.com/law. And they are Laurel Petrolionis, which is either a person or a Harry Potter spell. Lewis, Alexander Thomas, True Path, Alex Vaughn, and visually impaired and need help with Apple products, visit applevis.com. That's Apple and VIS.com. That's an interesting spot there, but thank you for the support. Yeah. And we're pleased to give the shout out.
Absolutely. And thank you to Andrew Connor, to Donovan, to Kietel Hope. I hope I'm pronouncing that correctly. Anna Williamson and Heath Rensink. Thanks to all of you for supporting the show over at patreon.com/law. We literally could not do this show without that support. It is crucial. And if you like the show and would like to signal that support to us, tell us you appreciate us giving away the show for free and participate in all of the free goodies and bonuses we do, like the Q&A and like Lawed Awful Movies, head on over to patreon.com/law and throw us a buck or two, man. You help us out.
Absolutely. And now it is time to find out if I can keep my improbable one question streak alive and extend it to two. I don't feel that confident about this one, but we'll see.
Oh, no associate of this firm has ever failed the bar exam.
No kidding.
So this was a question about Daphne, aka Eli Bosnick, committed vegan who snuck into her employer's supermarket and sprinkled a, quote, nausea-inducing chemical on all the meat, fish, and fowl products, and then accidentally poured too much on one packet of ground beef. A woman bought the ground beef, brought it home, gave it to her husband. Her husband was unusually susceptible to the chemical, died as a result of ingesting it. What would Daphne be found guilty of? And our options were first-degree murder because of willful premeditation. That was A. You eliminated that right off the bat. That's a good elimination, right? There was obviously no willful, deliberate, premeditated intent to kill anybody.
That was a freebie.
Yep. B was your second choice, first degree murder, since the homicide occurred during the perpetration of a felony. And you kind of agonized over that one, ultimately passed on it. Good decision to pass. Ooh. I will tell you this question, and I'm glad we're doing it. Some bar questions are set up this way where this defined the law. And at the end of the question, you may recall, it defined murder and said all murder which is perpetrated by willful, deliberate, or premeditated killing, or which is committed in the perpetration of or attempt to perpetrate arson, rape, robbery, or burglary is murder of the first degree. All other kinds of murders are murders of the second degree. So even if it were felony murder, the felony of sneaking into the... Yeah, it wasn't among the enumerated ones. So,
oh my gosh, you're right. I totally blanked on that. That was lucky that I still could guess the right answer, but... Boy, that was something I should have caught, and I didn't.
Yeah, well, it didn't hurt you this time. And when you were thinking about choosing B, I so wanted to be like, look to the bottom of our question.
How did I do that? That's so funny. Like, I have this false memory of seeing felony in there, but that's just my brain tricking me. So I got to be more careful next time.
So you passed on B, good pass. C is second degree murder, since the circumstances show that she acted with an abandoned and malignant heart. And you said, I don't know what the hell abandoned and malignant heart is. I have to tell you, I have not seen that phrasing either. Usually in criminal law, the phrasing that you see is depraved indifference or depraved heart. And the way in which depraved heart has typically been defined at common law is wanton and willful misconduct, which means conduct that the defendant knows will create a very high risk of death or serious bodily injury. So leaving aside, I don't know what malignant heart means. If you interpret it as depraved indifference, depraved heart, this isn't depraved heart murder, right? Depraved heart murder is, you know,
Chainsaw Massacre.
No, well, I was going to say, like, you know, Pulp Fiction, right? Like, you're standing on the other end of the room and I'm firing wildly in your direction. I'm not specifically intending to shoot at you, but I don't care whether I hit you or not. And it's highly likely that I'm going to hit you. And that doesn't meet the criteria here.
Right, but since in her intentions, she did only mean to do like a small amount of this, it doesn't raise to the level of like trying to, not even caring if you killed somebody, I guess.
That is exactly right. So okay. That leaves as the best answer, the answer you chose, D, involuntary manslaughter, since she did not intend to kill anyone. And
yeah. It was as simple as that, huh?
It was as simple as that.
Good. Well,
I was going to say her conduct did create some risk of death, but it's not at the level that you would say is so severe as to support a charge for murder. That really, that, you know, it's a charge for manslaughter.
Oh, all right. Well, two in a row. Wow. What is my total? I have no idea lately.
Yeah. Thomas, you have now gotten 37 out of 65 questions correct, which I think is pretty darn good. And that is a rate of 56.9%. So we are trending back up to D minus. That's our target. But I have to tell you, you know, you could pass, you know, we got to get you over some of the essay questions, but there are plenty of lawyers who get less than 60% on the multi-state. So
All right. Doing okay. Well, that just leaves you to jump in your time machine and future Andrew, tell us who our lucky winner, who we're going to shower with fame and fortune, riches beyond your ability to perceive them. So that's why you can't see them, but they're there.
Meanwhile, at the Hall of Justice.
Well, Thomas, most people this week wanted to bet against you. A couple of folks got it right, but got it right in an uninteresting way. And a lot of people were stuck between B and C. So I'm going to pick the funniest C answer. There was a lot of good ones. And that is Matthew Cravat. That is at MattheWKrevat at Matthew Cravat on Twitter, who says, I have to go with C is for cookie, and that's good enough for me. But make it a vegan cookie just to be safe. You know what? Vegan and gluten-free. Organic vegan gluten-free cookie. Free-range organic gluten-free vegan cookie. So that was channeling Cookie Monster and quite possibly my favorite episode of Sesame Street, where Cookie Monster is in the library. And if that's what that's a shout out to, Matthew, we're giving you a shout out as well. So everyone give Matthew Cravat a follow on Twitter and send him some Sesame Street memes.
All right. Well, thanks for listening so much. Congrats to our big winner in the future. And also keep playing everybody else. It's always another opportunity to get vast untold riches. And Andrew, thanks as always for the great breakdowns. And we'll all be sitting here drunk on Yodel Mountain, passing out amongst the crowd.
There you go.
You betray the law! Law!
This has been Opening Arguments with Andrew and Thomas. If you love the show and want to support future episodes, please visit our Patreon page at patreon.com/law. If you can't support us financially, it'd be a big help if you could leave us a 5-star review on iTunes, Stitcher, or whatever podcast delivery vehicle you use. And be sure to tell all your friends about us. For questions, suggestions, and complaints, email us at openarguments@gmail.com. The show notes and links are on our website at www.openargs.com. Be sure to like our page on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @openargs. Until next time. This podcast is a production of Opening Arguments Media, LLC. All rights reserved.
Opening Arguments is produced with the help of our editor, Brian Ziegenhagen, production assistant, Natalie Newell, and our unofficial researcher, Magpie. A special thanks to the moderators of the Opening Arguments Facebook community, Natalie, Alicia Cook, Eric Brewer, and Emily Waters. And also thanks to Thomas Smith, who wrote and produced all of the amazing music you hear, which is used with his permission. Eat shit, Bob.